3:30 having arrived, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability will come to order. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bellick. Senator Brady. Senator Frericks. Representative McCarthy. Senator Murphy. Representative Myers. Representative Nekritz. Representative Poe. Representative Riley. Senator Schoenberg. Senator Severson. Senator Trotter.
Total of five members have answered the roll. We're also joined by Senator Hutchinson and Representative Dugan. We will be hearing testimony today on the, in accordance with the State Facility Closure Act, on two facilities, Department of Corrections, the Jesse Ma Houston Adult Transition Center and the Kankakee Minimum Security Unit. It's our understanding that we will be have consolidated testimony both from the department and from some of the others who wish to testify in the interest of time so that we can, everybody can get back on the road at a reasonable hour in anticipation of the weather worsening. With that, if there are members who wish to make any opening statements or comments, we will call upon Director Randall to offer his testimony. If the if you could turn your mic on, and if the clerk could also add Senator Brady to the roll. With Senator Brady's arrival, I believe a quorum is present, so we will be able to conduct a vote today. Is that correct? If there's a motion, we could do it. I think we need seven. Oh, that's right. Okay. So we would need, I stand corrected, we would need seven people who are members of the commission to be present in order to have a vote. Otherwise, we'll have to defer the final vote to another time. Please proceed. I'm sorry. Senator Trotter.
Mr. Chairman, if you could, for those who probably do not know, can you sort of inform them what our vote will mean as we go forward?
Sure. According to the State Facility Closure Act, there is a hearing within 25 miles of the facility that is proposed to be closed. The commission, after hearing testimony, votes to make an advisory recommendation to the administration and to the General Assembly as to whether a facility should remain open or be closed. However, that's an advisory opinion, that's not binding. The executive branch has the prerogative of proceeding as it wishes. The reason why we have this law is so that there is the opportunity to have some transparency and open public discussion as to the rationale behind a proposed facility disclosure. And as part of what's required in the law, we also examine the economic impact that would have upon a community. The Department of Corrections in this case has furnished us, in accordance with the law, necessary recommendation for closure that touches upon 10 points, most prominently that being the economic impact that would occur. And that will be the basis of our discussion. But so that everyone is clear, the commission's role is to advise on what course of action the legislative branch thinks is most appropriate. The ultimate decision does rest with the executive branch. Director, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen of the commission, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to begin discussions about IDOC's plans to address a $50 million budget shortfall as it relates to this unprecedented financial crisis. The proposals to close the Kankakee Minimum Security Unit and the Jesse Mon Houston Adult Transition Center are part of a larger strategy based on the long-term population needs of the prison system. Simply put, the Illinois prison population is not increasing and has not been growing for a prolonged period. Over the past 10 years, we have seen stability in the male inmate population and a decline in the female offenders sentenced to prison. On November 30th of 2001, the prison population stood at 45,622 inmates. In fiscal year 2009, there were about 500 less inmates, totaling 45,083. The primary reason why the prison population has not been growing is that court admissions have remained about the same for the past 5 years. Consistently, these court admissions have totaled between 28,000 and 29,000 cases each fiscal year, reflecting almost no change. This fiscal year, court admissions continue to follow the same pattern. Based on this data, there is no expectation at this point that the prison population will increase unless local level criminal justice processes change to reflect more prosecutions. By closing these two facilities, IDOC will realize an annualized savings of about $5.8 million and address overtime in other facilities as a result of staff relocation. The determination to close these two facilities are the initial results of IDOC's continuing efforts to evaluate fiscal and staffing efficiencies throughout the state prison system as it relates to prison population, operational factors, and program services. There is and will continue to be a need to continue to evaluate and change the individual missions of prisons and populations throughout the department based on sentencing patterns by the courts, types of offenders who are admitted to IDOC, and the budgetary challenges this agency is facing. Having said this, I will provide you with the specifics regarding Kankakee's Minimum Security Unit and Jesse Mon Houston. The Kankakee Minimum Security Unit is a female satellite facility that is managed by the Dwight Correctional Center with the capacity to hold 200 offenders. As of October this year, the offender population at Kankakee stood at 78 inmates. The last time the number of inmates exceeded 100 offenders at this facility was in September of 2006. In November of 2000, the IDOC's female population peaked at 2,976 inmates. Currently, there are 2,529 females housed in IDOC. The female facilities are currently operating at about 81% of capacity, with more than 600 beds currently available. Eliminating 200 beds at Kankakee's Minimum Security Unit would increase that percentage to 86% of total beds available. The reason for the decline in the eventual stabilization of this population are largely attributed to reductions in court admissions for female offenders. There is no indication that female admissions will increase enough to continue utilizing Kankakee's Minimum Security Unit. By the end of this year, 17 offenders from that facility will be released from this facility, leaving only 61 offenders who would need to be relocated to Dwight, Lincoln, Decatur, and Fox Valley ATCs based on this proposal. these 61 offenders will have an opportunity to choose the facility of their relocation. Budgetary savings associated with the closure of Kankakee are projected at $1.3 million for fiscal year 2010 and an annual savings of $4 million thereafter. The closure would allow the 45 affected staff to be transferred to either Dwight, Pontiac, or Sheridan to help alleviate overtime costs at those facilities. Dwight is 29 miles from Kankakee, Pontiac is 52 miles, and Sheridan is 57 miles. In an effort to determine the economic impact of the proposed closure, the department contracted with Western Illinois University to conduct a joint economic impact analysis of the areas surrounding Kankakee and Jesse Mon Houston, ATC. That study found the closures would result in an economic loss of about $3.4 million, 16 full-time positions, and about $840,000 loss in revenue for entities doing business with the two facilities. At the same time, those targeted regions receiving increases in staff and inmates transferring from to nearby facilities will experience economic growth. It's my understanding that staff is here today from Western Illinois University to field questions regarding that study. At this point, I'd like to turn my attention to Jesse Mon Houston. Jesse Mon Houston is an adult transition center for male offenders is located in Dixmoor, Illinois. As of October of this year, the offender population stood at 81 inmates and has the capacity to hold 140 offenders. IDOC data shows that other ATC facilities have the capacity to absorb these offenders held at Jesse Mon Houston, as closing this facility would still leave approximately 100 available beds. The ATC would then operate, all of our ATCs would then operate at roughly 90% of capacity. In fiscal year 2001, the male prison population was 42,746 inmates. As of November of this year, the male population was at 42,569 inmates, a decline of 177 inmates. The adult transition center population has also declined steadily since 2002 and is currently 992 inmates. Limited changes in overall admissions and court admissions are the reasons for the long-term stabilization of the male inmate population. IDOC intends to move the affected staff and inmates to Westside ATC, which is located in Chicago. Westside ATC has the capacity to house 215 offenders and currently houses only 93. By moving the majority of the 29 staff from Jesse Mon Houston to Westside, it will increase the staffing at Westside and provide the necessary resources to accommodate the 81 inmates from Jesse Mon Houston. In addition, there are staff vacancies at Fox Valley ATC that Jesse Mon Houston staff can relocate to as well. The budgetary savings associated with the closure of Jesse Mon Houston ATC allows for about $1 million to be saved during fiscal year 2010 and a minimum of $1.8 million each year after. Jesse Mon Houston ATC is in poor condition as reflected in the health and safety inspections. To bring this facility up to safety standards, the owner or the state would have to allocate funds to make needed improvements. The current annualized cost of operating Jesse Mon Houston is about $4.2 million. Of this $4.2 million in spending, nearly $1.8 is spent on paying property taxes and rent. Actual operating cost of the facility is about $2.4 million. At a minimum, IDOC will save nearly $1.8 million associated with the property tax and rent at Jesse Mon Houston. As noted earlier, the department contracted with Western Illinois University to conduct a joint economic impact analysis of the areas surrounding both Kankakee and Jesse Mon Houston. The closures would result in the same $3.4 million and 16 full-time employees and $840,000 loss in revenue for entities doing business with both these facilities. At the same time, those targeted regions receiving increases in staff and inmates transferring to nearby facilities will experience economic growth. This is the conclusion of my testimony, and at this point, I would take any questions that the commission may have.
Thank you. Questions of commission members for director. Senator Trotter.
Sir, on both sites, you cited that the U of I gave a report about what the economic loss would be, but you said there will be none. How did they determine that there would not be a loss?
I'm sorry.
To the surrounding communities, unless I heard wrong.
Mr. Senator, yes, there will be an economic loss. In fact, the study says that it is a combined economic impact for both facilities, and the loss from the result of the closures will be an economic loss of about $3.4 million and 16 full-time positions, as well as $840,000 in loss of revenue for entities doing business with both facilities. Yes.
But if you break them up, so what does that mean to Kankakee, and what does that mean to Dixmoor?
I think it may be to our advantage to ask if there is a representative from Western Illinois University to come up.
Thank you. The analysis.
Excuse me, could you please identify yourself for the record?
Excuse me, yes, I'm Robin Hanna. I'm with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. We conducted the analysis for the Department of Corrections. We were asked to do an analysis of the combined loss of local purchasing and commodity contracting for both the two facilities as a single total. And we looked at the impact on an 8-county region. So we're unable to split the negative economic impacts between the two facilities at this point in time.
It seems that's a little unfair. Even without your report, I think everyone in this room, and certainly those who reside in this area, knows that Dixmoor is one of the most depressed communities in the entire state, probably second to maybe East St. Louis, if not worse, and not to say what the immediate economic impact would be to them in particular in this little quarter, I think makes your report sort of incomplete. That was the people crying for their jobs.
Again, the analysis looked at a regional impact and did not specify a locality. And so I'm not able to address that this time.
And I can't continue to beat that horse. You said there's going to be you're looking at a $50 million deficit in your budget this year. And you'll save roughly, what?
5.8
from both facilities. Mm-hmm. How are you addressing the other deficits or reductions you're going to have to make in your budget?
The department is currently doing several different things to address that $50 million gap. As you're aware, we've been under a modified hiring freeze. We've been only limiting our hiring to critical positions in the agency, as well as we've done about $2.5 million in cuts within our operation as a total. I've taken state cars away from executive staff. I've reduced the number of deputy directors and chiefs in this agency by 12 to 14 staff. We have to do a lot more. There'll be other cuts that we'll be assessing. We're in the process of trying to reduce staff at about four facilities, but unfortunately I got a judge that issued an injunction that is slowing down a process of reducing staff at several facilities. So we're doing a number of things, and there will be a number of other things this agency will have to do in order to address.
Yeah, it would seem, because what you've just talked about and seeing those numbers in the past, that doesn't add up anywhere near $50 million. That you need to reduce on. Have you factored in, you know, the big talk now is the selling of Thompson, and that would be, what, $1 billion? How much are we proposing we might get for that sale?
I'm not sure that there's been a number discussed about what we would get. If you're asking what it costs to construct the facility, it's between 128 and 140.
I remember when it was built. So yeah. No, we've that money's spent. So we're now saying if we're selling it and to the feds, that we'll get a significant number. And do you have a proposed date? I know they're just going through their various vetting systems. And we're still debating the issue here as well. How long that would be, would those dollars be realized in next year, in the next fiscal year?
I have not been told what the date would be. I have not been told that it has even been approved by the federal government. So we are kind of in a waiting stage as it relates to Thompson.
Yeah, it's going to be approved, but you should at least have some type of idea what is the value of Thompson and what will that dollar impact mean besides the 3,800 jobs that it's generally going to ultimately generate over there and the regional impact that it'll have through the years. But that first infusion of dollars, what would that impact mean?
I apologize, but I'm really...
Or has the governor already spent all that money?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess as it relates to that facility, you know, we have to go through the same process when it comes to that. And I know the first step in that process would be to get an appraisal of the facility, essentially. And I know that's the first step so that you have a real number of what the value of the facility is. And I think that's where you start. That has not happened yet. I know that is something that needs to happen before we'll know what the value is.
Yes, as I said, all politics are local. You know how that goes. Mm-hmm. I, for one, and I think everyone on this panel realizes the situation that we're in right now with the absence of new revenue streams, the deferred maintenance that's due on all of our old facilities, and I mean just a whole myriad of things that have to be done to get this, to keep this system at least with some kind of integrity.
Yes.
That it's going to cost dollars, but being that all politics is local, certainly being here in this on the south side or the south suburbs, which impacts on my community, which hasn't always been the recipients of things when times were good, and now for us to be slapped when times are bad, it just seems like it's that old double jeopardy kind of thing. You know, when do we start building something and try to continue some kind of growth? I'm sure there's going to be other questions and those members as well, but those are my concerns.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
We've also been joined this afternoon by Representative Will Davis, and the next member who wishes to seek recognition is Representative McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenberg. Director, I'm looking at the list of different ATCs, and North Lawndale and West Side are going to remain open. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
I'm always worried about my geography, but North Lawndale is usually considered a West Side of Chicago type area, just a little bit farther north than the West Side there. So how was the decision made to close the one in the south suburbs when it seems like those two are closer to each other? If one had to be closed, I mean, how was that determined, and how is it determined where an inmate would be assigned after he's leaving correctional facility to go to one of the ATCs?
Mr. Chairman, a couple ways, and primarily the decision with regards to Jesse Moss specifically was based on two primary factors: the number of inmates that were housed there, which was 81. It's very easy for us to absorb those inmates into other facilities that had more capacity and could hold more inmates. And secondly, because we have a lease for this facility, we could give 30 days notice and vacate the property to get the maximum amount of savings. The other real important factor was the condition of the facility itself. It is not in the best of shape. We would have, or the owner would have had to make significant capital investments in that facility in order to make it at least fairly acceptable in terms of the living conditions in that facility. So those things coupled with our ability to get the savings, and when you look at the dollar amount that the amount of money we pay to operate that facility compared to the number of offenders in that facility, it would equate to about $50,000 per inmate that we are spending to operate that facility. And so, when we look at all of that, it just made sense given the circumstance.
So there's a lease at the Jesse Mai Houston, which we can't get out of after 30 days. Do we own the property at the West Side and at the North Lawndale locations?
I'm not 100% sure, Tony. We lease those.
We lease those as well. And is that the reason we're paying property tax? Because I was kind of shocked when your testimony said about losing property tax to that area, because I know from my good friend Representative Davis that he's very concerned with the reduction in property tax in his area, which is already really stressed. So,
Mr. Chairman, I guess what I've been told in terms of the history, when we entered into this lease, part of the state's agreement with the owners was that the state would be responsible for the payment of property taxes for that property to the tune of $1 million.
Is that the same way at West Side, though? Is it?
No, it is not.
But we do pay rent there.
Pardon me?
We do pay rent, so the obvious conclusion would be that part of our rent must be going for the property taxes, or otherwise the person would be losing.
Right.
He's not doing it on his own, that's for sure.
You're absolutely right, but in this case, the property tax is separate from the rent at Jesse Mai. We pay $777,000 a year in rent at Jesse Mai on top of the $1 million in property tax that we pay for that facility.
And that was the lease that was determined back in 2000 when it was
first? No, that lease has been in place since 2000.
Okay. And when they opened in 2000, you're talking about the deterioration of the facility. Was it new in 2000, or was it completely refurbished? It seems like, how come we didn't know about this? So how could it get just unlivable now in 2009? Or was it a gradual thing over the years? Or why wasn't it taken care of? It doesn't seem like that old. I mean, we have prisons that are 130 years old that we still have people in. And so if this one's only 10 years old, how would you explain why it's in such terrible shape?
Well, I'm not sure that I can explain that. But I'm not sure, Tony, if you want to add something to this. If it pleases the chair, if you want the owners to give testimony, I guess that's fine. But I can't explain why the facility is in the condition that it's in.
Yeah, but in the numbers we have, which I think were provided by your department, does show that while the North Lawndale has about 90% occupancy, the West Side actually has a lower percent than the one we're closing.
Yeah, part of the plan is to transfer those 81 inmates that are currently at Jesse Mai over to West Side and increase that population as well as the staff associated with that.
And per inmate or whatever, is there a lesser cost at the West Side than there is currently at Jesse Mai?
Now, I need to double check, but I would assume that there is because we're
I hope
not
so.
Paying $1 million in property taxes there.
All right.
So, on to you.
Okay. My name is Tony Small. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Department of Corrections. The West Side lease is about $642,000 a year.
That includes everything?
That includes everything.
Okay.
So when you just make that comparison of the 642 versus the rental at Jesse Mai, which is almost $800,000, plus the taxes, that in itself shows that Jesse Mai is a more expensive place to operate based on state funds. Like the director.
And the personnel is about approximate.
Correct.
They're both, okay. So, and that was $1 million plus the $150,000 just in the lease.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions from other members of the panel? Representative Bellick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't sure I heard what you said the cost was per inmate.
look at the total, when you look at the total cost to operate the facility, mm-hmm. it's about $4.2 million,
right.
and you divide that up by 81 inmates, mm-hmm. you come up with right around $50,000 per inmate annually, mm-hmm. to operate that facility.
Mm-hmm. And are you assuring the personnel that they will be employed somewhere else in one of the other?
What I can commit to is offering up opportunities for those affected employees to go to, in Kankakee's case, mm-hmm. Pontiac, Sheridan, or Dwight. Mm-hmm. In Jesse Ma's case, Westside ATC, mm-hmm. or in some cases, Fox Valley ATC. We have a number of vacancies at all four of those facilities that can be made available to those staff.
And
I might add, Fox Valley, Westside and Jesse Ma are less than 25 miles in this distance from each other.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. Are they all within 50 miles of one another?
For Kankakee, it's a little bit further when it comes to Sheridan and Pontiac. I think mm-hmm. Sheridan is 52 miles and Pontiac is 57 miles from Kankakee. But Dwight is 29 miles. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Representative Davis.
Well, I got, there it is, got a green light there. Director, thank you very much for the information that you've shared. And Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's at some point appropriate for questions to the owners after we're finished with the department personnel, but that may warrant some conversation. But one question that I have for you, Director, as Senator Trotter was asking you about Thompson Correctional Facility, and we've heard, and I don't know if these numbers have been generated by the Department of Corrections, but we've heard a lot about what the economic impact is to Thompson being sold and to that area. And again, I don't know if those numbers are coming out of your department at all or your agency, but in the same manner that we're looking at what appears to be the positive benefits of Thompson, can you speak to or have any numbers what may be the negative impact of this facility closure to that region?
In terms of the Thompson and the economic impact, I think those numbers came out of the federal government and the White House in terms of the potential economic impact of that facility. As it relates to the negative with these two facilities, anytime we lose options in our department, it's not to our benefit in terms of having potential options to house offenders in as many different environments and options to place people. But I also have to look at the reality of our budget situation, and these are some of the most expensive bids we operate. So it's a negative in the sense that as a system, we won't have two facilities available to us where we can do some specialized things with specialized populations. So certainly that's a negative in terms of giving us flexibility. But at the same time, given the financial circumstances, we have to continue to sort of contract our resources until we can get through this financial crisis. So hope I tried to answer that.
Well, not quite. But if the information is not generated out of your
right.
department, then I really can't
right.
expect you to answer that necessarily. So, but if Mr. Small can at some point try to wrap his arms around what the financial impact of particularly Jesse Ma. Is to that region, I'd like to at least have some idea of what
the region of
what
Thompson
that
or
No. I asked you about Thompson because we talk a lot about the
okay.
positive impacts, but I'm asking you about the economic impact, be it maybe negative, of Jesse Ma.
Okay.
Because as you know, I represent the village of Dixmoor where that facility is located. So I'm just asking you to wrap your arms around what you think the economic impact may be. again, I think it's going to be negative, obviously, because you're closing the facility. But I'm just curious to know.
See some specific.
Right. I mean, we could talk about what could be. Okay. If you can frame that as a result of loss of contracts, property taxes,
local services.
I think there are some local.
I think it's similar to the question that was asked earlier about being able to separate out the economic study between Kankakee and Jessima rather than
Abbott. Then you understand exactly what I'm asking for.
Gotcha.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it costs you about $50,000 per inmate at Jessima Houston?
If you take, yes, the $4.2 million and divide that by the 81 offenders you have there.
Well, how was that in comparison to the other facilities?
On an average as a system, it's about $23,000 a year per offender.
Per vendor,
yes.
With the other facilities?
Yes.
Okay, and this one is about $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can certainly understand what the concern is. So if I asked you to, and I hope you don't go to, you know, just you're looking at your overall budget situation. I guess what I'm getting at here is that obviously it's costing a lot more to operate this facility than others. So has there been any attempt recently to try to renegotiate the lease, to try to reduce those costs? And then ultimately what I'm asking is, outside of the overall budget situation and corrections or in the state period, is there one particular reason that you can point to say why we need to close, if you will, this facility? Is it the infrastructure issues? Is it just that per cost inmate? You know, I'm just trying to figure out what the department has done over the years, you know, to maybe try to see if they can mitigate some of these costs and make them more in line with other facilities. And then my other question, Mr. Small, and I don't know how long you've been the CFO in corrections. How long is that, sir?
About 10 years.
About 10 years. Yeah. So you predate this particular lease, correct? Close to it?
I predate working on the Department of Corrections budget back to 1985. So
okay.
I've been involved with corrections since 85.
Okay. Well, and you may or may not have the institutional knowledge that I'm looking for, but I'm just trying to understand, because the idea of paying rent and then on top of that paying property taxes, I'm just trying to figure out who wrote this and where this came from. I mean, that would put it in this kind of context. That's all. I'm just trying to understand where this came from. Obviously, it predates me as a legislator. I didn't start to 2003, but nevertheless, here we are. And if part of the reason that it needs to be closed, if we're talking about overall budget constraints, is the way the lease is currently structured, then I'm just asking why, or have there been efforts to restructure this lease over, you know, the last couple of years or however long? I don't know. Is this lease up every year, or?
The lease is currently in holdover and has been in holdover for a long time.
What does holdover mean? Explain that to us.
Holdover means basically that we're on a month-to-month lease with the owner.
You said for a long time?
Management Services is responsible for negotiating the lease with our landlord.
And that's without any input or any information from corrections at all?
Well, we do.
Okay. Oh, well, there we go.
Good afternoon. My name is Nick Cantalopoulos. I'm the Acting Deputy Director for Property Management at CMS. CMS is responsible for both entering into the initial lease that's at issue here today and attempting to, as you said, renegotiate or enter into a new deal on this property. Unfortunately, this is an old deal. It predates basically anyone who's currently at CMS in the position of a lease representative or even an attorney in Chicago. So it is difficult to get a history of how we entered into the current arrangement. What I will tell you is that there's language under the property tax section of the lease which states, typically the way taxes are handled by the state is we set what's termed a base year for the taxes. We say that the landlord's responsible for now 2009 taxes payable in 2010. We will pay everything above that base year. So if those taxes were $100 and then the year after they're $102, we would pay $2. The landlord is responsible for the $100. There's a baseline set. In this case, this was a build out. So the property was assessed as vacant I believe, vacant land before this was entered into. So the property taxes would be incredibly low. In that case, our language, our lease has standard language that the property taxes would be, in that point, I think it was 1997, payable in 98, or the first year, the first fully assessed year after the improvements are done. In this lease, that language, which means we're going to build a building, when it's assessed after the building is built, that those property taxes will set the baseline, and we will pay everything above that. In this lease, that language is X'd out. We, Central Management Services is responsible currently for approximately 550 leases in the state of Illinois. When I started with the department 4 years ago, I think we had over 700 leases. I have never seen that done in any other lease. That is not the way I would handle it, or I would instruct any of my staff to handle that situation if it were to arise today, if we were responsible for all the taxes.
Okay, so this lease has been in holdover for how long then?
Not that long. I believe about less than a year.
Holdover for less than a year. So prior to that, there were no opportunities to... So, I mean, I can appreciate what you're saying about, you know, no one has any institutional knowledge because you got new people coming in. So at what point do, when someone new shows up and has the responsibility of looking at all of this, saying, here's a red flag, why don't we see what we can do to address it? But what point does that happen?
Well, that did happen. And that happened. See, in this case, there's a little bit of difficulty because this is a lease where, in many of our leases, CMS pays all the expenses, and then through the Facility Management Revolving Fund, and then we get reimbursed by agencies for rent, property taxes, utilities, so on and so forth. This is what's termed a non-consolidated lease. We don't pay, we don't have knowledge of a lot of the expenses. They don't flow through CMS. So we did discover that it was brought to our attention that the property taxes were very high at this location by Department of Corrections. We looked at this. We looked at what could be done. We actually put this out for a request for information, and that did not yield a satisfactory result. And in discussions with Department of Corrections on what could possibly be done, increasing the boundaries to do another request for information, look for one in a broader area, eventually resulted in the decision to close the facility.
That's a more recent decision, correct?
As far as I'm aware, yes.
Okay, so can you speak to, if this was, and I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your indulgence. Can you speak to if the facility was built in 2000, which means that the first property assessment came, what, 1 or 2 years later? So what was that base that has now gotten us to where we are?
Well,
I'm curious about that, and maybe that's... Maybe too much information.
I don't have the tax information with me that goes back to day one.
Okay.
And I'm not even sure the file contains the tax information that goes back that far, the file that we currently have.
Okay.
However, at this point, we're responsible for over $800,000 in property taxes. I would suspect that is probably 95% of the total property tax bill, if not more. And that is a very unusual situation.
Okay. I mean, I hope you can understand my quandary here.
Yes.
Because while I constantly get beat up about fiscal responsibility from a variety of sources, I also have to be concerned about the economic impact of a community that unfortunately, you know, is in the position that it's in. And I want to recognize Mayor Kevin Grimmett from the Village of Dixmoor and his presence here today. He's got to think about what's going to happen to my community because I'm going to lose out so much. So my problem is that if we're to the point and if this figure is part of the reason why we have to make this decision, why wasn't addressed a little bit sooner than that? And while they may have lost some, now they're losing everything. And that's what's real tough to deal with right now, at least for me, from that area. And there are a lot of people that work in state government, have a lot of initials behind their name. I expect them to do probably more than probably what their titles or whatever suggests. I mean, we in being fiscally responsible, it's important that we take very proactive measures. And to me, this was not proactive at all. I mean, to get to this point, and now this community is going to simply lose out, and I'm curious to know what this impact is going to be, because it's going to be devastating to a community like this. And so I'm sorry it's gotten to this point, but, you know, while I said, here we are, now I've got a community that's going to lose everything and has nothing to simply replace it. So again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe I'll have, as other members, folks come to the table. But thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Dugan has asked to be recognized, but I want to, I'd like to ask you a couple questions while we have the representative from Central Management Services here. What year was the lease agreement entered into? And my next question will be, who was the director of Central Management Services at the time the lease agreement was entered into?
I believe it was Stephen Schwartz.
Okay. You mean Mike Schwartz?
Schnorf.
Steve Schnorf?
I apologize. The first month, we moved in November 1st, 1998.
Okay, so the Director of Central Management Services at the time was Stephen Schnorf?
So
that was during the Edgar administration? Or the Ryan administration? No, it was at the end of the Edgar administration. Okay. And could you, for the benefit of the members of the commission and those who are sitting in, could you, and everyone else, could you tell us, please, what the law, as it's been changed, reflects as to how long we allow a lease to go on with options before we require the state to buy the property so that we don't have bad lease arrangements that go on indefinitely?
Well, there's two, I guess, there's two statutes that are relatively, one's new and one kind of clarifies the duration of leases. One amendment to the duration of lease statute in the procurement code makes it clear that the length of a lease, including all renewals, shall be no longer than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I believe what you're asking is that the statute passed that states as of July 1st, 2010, the comptroller should not pay rent on any lease that has been in holdover in excess of 6 months.
Right. And the reason behind that is?
Well, the CMS has, over the last several years, has had a very large backlog of holdover leases, and that creates a lot of administrative issues for the state, and the statute is to prevent that, to get us to eliminate the backlog and to prevent that from occurring in the future.
So I have to admit, I was the one who wrote those changes in the law, so I knew answers before I even asked the question.
Did I get them right?
And the reason why I asked the question is because I think, in fairness, Director Sludge, it has now made a very concerted effort to address that backlog of holdover leases. You know, by leases falling into that category of a quote-unquote holdover leases, what we saw, especially during the previous administration, is that it stopped the clock. It had the impact of stopping the clock, and therefore it hurt the taxpayers because these leases were in limbo. And the whole purpose of the change in the law was to force the state to own the property because that's a more favorable deal than renting indefinitely from a landlord. Those changes to the law were designed to protect the taxpayers. So I wanted just to follow up on that question that Representative Davis was asking, because I think it provides a little more clarity, one, as to under which administration this agreement was originally entered into, and two, why this wasn't dealt with previously. There were hundreds of leases that weren't dealt with in a timely fashion. That was a deliberate action. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't because there weren't enough people to deal with it. That was by design. That was by design by the prior administration, not to. And as a result, they weren't complying really with the law, and the taxpayers were the ones who wore the jacket financially for that. Well, this is, it sounds like there are other factors that enter into it. I was just focusing and trying to help you out a bit on the real estate portion of this. Before I call on Representative Dugan, I also want to point out there have been a couple questions as to the value of Thompson. We're not really here to discuss Thompson. We will have hours and hours of opportunity to discuss Thompson on December 22nd. In what will be the only public hearing, most likely, about that facility. The law provides that in determining the value of the Thompson Correctional Center or any other facility where the state, if it should be designated as surplus property, will divest itself from it, that requires three appraisals, and those three appraisals are averaged into one figure. So. But we'll hear all about that on the 22nd at 2 o'clock at the Sterling High School. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions. The Kankakee Minimum Security Facility, do we own it? Yes. So DOC actually owns the Kankakee. Where we're looking to transfer the inmates from Kankakee, are there areas of those facilities that are minimum security?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There are areas at Dwight, Lincoln, and Decatur where we currently house minimum security females. I have the option, and one of the options that I'm considering is whether or not to designate one of those facilities as a minimum security facility, but at a minimum, we have units or buildings where we house minimum security offenders. The other option for specifically for the females at Kankakee, I'm giving them the option to go to the Fox Valley Adult Transition Center if they meet the criteria. Out of the 61 women that will be impacted by the Kankakee closure, 50 or so meet the criteria to be eligible to be transferred to Fox Valley. Now, I've got about 34 bids today available at Fox Valley, and I anticipate having other bids over the next few weeks. And so even if a portion that would like to transfer to Fox Valley can't with this first group, as I have bids available, they'll be the first to transfer over to Fox Valley. So they'll be going to a combination of places. Each place has minimum security females in it presently.
Okay, and the programs that we have at the minimum security facility at Kankakee, mm-hmm. those same programs are available at the facilities that you're talking about the lady's going to?
The same types of programs and more, because those are larger facilities with larger populations, so there is more programming happening there. It's not the same group or the same facilitators that are doing the programming, but the same types of programming is available at each of those facilities.
Okay, and I only have one other question. I don't know that you can actually give me an answer today on it, but I want to make sure I understood you correctly. You said if we close Kankakee, then the first year we would save so much, and every year after that we would save $4 million?
Yes.
On this paper that I'm looking at, it says the operational cost for the Kankakee Minimum Security is $4
million. That's an annual cost.
Okay, so how do we save $4 million annually if that's what it costs us? Because we're still going to have to keep staff. We're still going to have the cost of the inmates. They'll just be somewhere else. I guess I'm just trying to figure out in my mind, how do we save $4 million if we only spend $4 million? We still have the same inmates, and we still have staff and that kind of thing. So how do we?
Well, combination. Sure, a good question. Couple things. And we'll deal with the staff first, and then we'll deal with the inmates. The staff
The plan is for those staff to be transferred to Dwight, Sheridan, or Pontiac. All three of those facilities currently run enormous overtime. I run about over $3 million in overtime at Pontiac. I run about $1.3 million at Sheridan. And actually, I run the $3 million at Dwight. I run about $1.3 at Sheridan. And I run about $1 million at Pontiac. Now, when these staff go or transfer to those other facilities, they'll go to relieve some of those overtime costs. For example, at Dwight, I'm going to save close to $1 million in overtime, and it's in the report. The actual figures are in the report. I'm going to save about $600,000 in overtime costs at Sheridan, and I'm going to save around $900,000 in overtime at Pontiac. And so those staff will immediately begin to relieve overtime costs, and those 45 staff cost me about $2.5 million a year in salaries. So when you combine those numbers, I'm about $200,000 ahead just by moving those staff to those other facilities to cover my overtime.
Okay, and if it's in the report, Director, then I can, and like I said, because I'm not even on this commission, so I don't want to take too much of their time.
Now, with the inmates, if I transfer 50 inmates to a prison, I'm not giving the warden a penny. They have to absorb the cost of those inmates in their operation, because if they got 2,000 inmates and I increase them by 50, 60, 70 inmates, I'm not giving them any additional dollars, because they only have the daily marginal costs. They're not increasing staffing. They're not doing anything different than what they presently do. They just have 50 more people that they...
Right, but I mean, we still have to feed those same people that we fed at the other place.
Right.
We still have to have staff in order to take care of them that we had at the other place. That's why I'm trying to figure it out.
But they're not going to increase their staff for those 30, 40, 50 inmates that I send them, and you've got some, you've got some marginal costs, just the cost of food or medical care, but I'm not going to send those prisons any additional dollars.
Okay, well, and like I said, and I appreciate your answers. Like I said, and I'll read the report. I'm having a hard time comprehending how we save when we still have the issues. We're just putting it in another place. But thank you.
Okay.
Hutchinson.
Hello. Okay. Thank you for speaking to a number of those other questions were ones that I know that I had mentioned to you, because I was really concerned about programs. For people who we obviously don't want to see go back into the system. I don't want to lose sight of moving them from where they are and access to programs they have, so that when they do go out, their reintegration is somehow thwarted. So if programs are still available, that's a little bit better. But I did have one question about the Jesse Ma facility as well. Somebody mentioned earlier that this was a build-out when it happened in 98 or 2000, and so in less than 10 years now, the building is in such bad repair that we can't do anything to rehabilitate it, or it would be cost prohibitive to fix it in only 10 years?
Right.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, there was a statement earlier that we had the number of repairs and insignificant capital improvements to a building that we've only had control over for 10 years. So that was one issue that maybe we can hear from the owners.
Yeah.
The second thing is, if the lease had been at the point where it was, I know it's only been in holdover for less than 6 months or so, but at some point, was the lease supposed to be renegotiated every year, or is this a lease a year-to-year lease? It just keeps signing the same terms as they are. That's a little confusing as well. And I'd also like to know what the economic impact would be to the Kankakee area when you take a facility out that buys locally, that does, has service contracts, that contributes to the local economy as well, because separate those issues out, because we are going to have some other concerns in terms of losing, just the economic impact that goes around the people who work there and what they have to do to exist there every day.
Okay.
And I think everyone else answered pretty much everything else.
In response to the lease question, this was a 10-year lease from the date of its inception. So no, it wasn't renegotiated every year. It was for a term of 120 months.
What is it in Kankakee?
The cost per inmate.
and its relationship to system-wide? If it's 20, if it's an average of 23,000, it's 50,000 at Jesse Ma, what is it in the Kankakee minimum security?
$50,000 or $23,000?
And dealing with the overtime, does overtime happen in the other facilities? Just, is that based on guard to inmate ratios?
Mr. Chair.
Not enough staff to deal right. with the population that we have?
Well, absolutely. Overtime has to do with, actually, it's the fact that we hadn't been hiring in IDOC for about 2 years, and our staffing levels got so low that we were running overtime, mandating people on a daily basis to significant numbers. And so that's what's driving this overtime. And we've had four cadet classes already. We've hired in the last 6 months close to 600 correction officers to begin to address the overtime. But at the same time, I have a huge attrition rate in this agency, and so the catch-up rate is slow. That's why activities like this help to get me quicker to saving dollars in terms of overtime.
Okay, and then what has there been any thought to the other, like the opposite direction? So if there's 200 bed capacity in Kankakee, you know, and we'll have 17 scheduled to release, we've got 61 there. There can't be only 61 minimum security eligible people in the area. Could we not reduce some of the populations and have a more efficient use of the facilities we already operate? So boost the population to 200 and then make it a more efficient facility that is already there?
It could if we wasn't seeing a decline in the female population in the system as a whole.
But you already have larger programs that you said are in Sheridan or in Pontiac and are in Dwight,
yeah.
And you have overtime issues in Sheridan, Pontiac, and Dwight.
Right.
So whether or not the population increases, it would seem that a better spread or a more efficient use of the population we have currently might also be another avenue to look at. In terms of an outright closure. In other words, increasing efficiencies as opposed to completely taking something out of the system.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right, Senator. And the problem with that is if you're looking at Kankakee, then you're dealing with female inmates. And I've got four prisons where I house female inmates. And so I don't have as many options. And quite frankly, we're doing some of that at other prisons, actually downsizing the prisons rather than closing them for the exact reasons that you all are talking about right now. I've got larger prisons that I'm actually reducing or attempting to reduce the number of employees there rather than do a closure at a large or a whole prison because of the impact to the community and some of the economics. We're trying to do that as well. These issues are so large, we're having to do a combination of closures, reductions, right. And I mean, everything you can right. To try to make up this gap that we're facing.
No, I completely understand the difficulty of where you find yourself right now, especially as a brand new director. I really relate to that. I walked into an impeachment, so I get that. But it would still seem those same kinds of considerations would be helpful in Kankakee, considering we're going to have 61 people in a place that can handle 200, and you've got populations that could be reduced in other areas, where then you have an efficient use of a building, and you don't take something completely out of a community that also has the corresponding economic impact to the larger community as well, is probably my largest concern.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for the Department of Corrections? If not, you may want to stand by. We're going to try to pick up the pace of this a bit, given the weather. And we'll hear now from, if it's all right with everyone, we'll hear briefly from the those representing the property owners to answer some of the questions that have been raised with respect to the real property.
Thanks. Mayor,
When everyone gets settled, if you could identify yourselves for the record before you begin speaking, that would be great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bruce Jackson. I'm an attorney. I represent Transitional Development, who is the owner and lessor of the Jesse Ma Houston Adult Transition Center. I was also the attorney that worked with the owner in putting together the lease. I worked with CMS back in the late 90s. Do have some on-the-ground, firsthand knowledge of how that all got stitched together. A long time ago, most of it, if not all of it, that I'll relate or respond to will be through recollection, and I'll try to be as accurate as possible. There are three points, I think, that we'd like to make, and very succinctly. Number one, we've heard the number $4.2 million, which is the operating budget or annual cost for Jesse Ma Houston. And we've also heard that that facility is consists of 81 inmates. And when you take that $4.2 million divided by the 81 inmates, you come up with a roughly $51,000 cost per inmate. Just as we heard a representative mention just now, she was much ahead of all of us on that curve. If you take the $4.2 million and you divide it by 200 beds, that cost per inmate is now $21,000. That cuts it in half. Now, why do I mention 200 beds when we've been talking about Jesse Ma Houston being a 130-bed facility? And not only have we been talking about it, you can look at the proposal that was submitted by the Department of Corrections, which states on page one that it's a 130-bed capacity facility, when in actuality, it's a 200-bed facility. It was designed that way by the architects who were hired by CMS and who provided the specifications to which the property was built. It was built that way by the owner and the contractor, and it has been always available to be conducted and operated in that way. Now, my understanding is that it's part of the facility, which is normally and which was designed to be used as housing, is currently being used as storage. And when I asked, well, what's being stored there, I was told furniture, beds, and just as it was suggested a moment ago, maybe if some consideration were to be given to taking what is already a resource in place and utilizing it to its fullest capacity, we wouldn't be having the discussions about the merits of moving it 25 miles away. I think the second point that we'd like to make that has been asserted as a basis for closing Jesse Ma Houston is the condition of the infrastructure and the facility itself. And we've heard follow-up questions with respect to, well, wait a minute, if this is a 10-year lease and this property was built, you know, stick-built, you know, to specifications, you know, why are we having infrastructure problems? And the evidence, at least as far as I've been able to see at this point, that supports that assertion that the infrastructure is under par is the attachment in the proposal from the Department of Correction of a safety and sanitation report, which, if you'll look at it, was dated almost 2 years ago today,
December the 5th, 2007. And we have the owner here today who will tell you without any question or doubt or any reservation or equivocation that every item on that two-year-old list has been and was corrected almost immediately at the cost of the owner. The other reason we have been told that this property infrastructure is under par is because it was built on a landfill and that the walls and floors and everything else are cracking. I have here a phase one environmental site assessment that was conducted by our environmental consultants back in 1999 who clearly state expressly and unequivocally that this property was not built on a landfill. And we can provide at least two references where it is stated in this report that that's not the case. And the third point that I think we'd like to make goes to the taxes. We heard the representative from CMS says that of the 500 or so leases of this type that exists in the state, no other one has been seen like this that provides for the taxes, all the taxes above the base year to be passed through to the state. And when I heard that comment, I went right back to something that we heard Senator Trotter mention when this session opened, and he said, made comments, he said, as far as I know, and I'm just paraphrasing here, he said, as far as I know, he says, I think Dixmoor is only second to East St. Louis in being severely economically impacted in this state. And ladies and gentlemen, that was precisely the reason I recall that type of term was allowed to be put in that lease. Because while there's no other place there may be no other lease in the state like that one that contains that clause, there's no other place in Illinois quite like Dixmoor. Today, nor was it in 1999. My recollection is that while the Central Management Services, in conjunction with its client, which was Illinois Department of Corrections, designated a geographical area within which to position the facility that they were requesting. And as discussions became underway and requests, responses to the request for proposal were submitted, all of this was competitive bidding, the discussion came to be, well, we think we might like it in Markham. And the reason why was because there was at least my recollection is, there was a prison population that came from that south suburban area that it would be responsive to the families of that prison population if that facility were located in this south suburban location, not on the west side of Chicago, because that's where the families of some of these inmates lived, and if they were nonviolent offenders with under 2 years left in their term, that their families would be able to visit them. The RFP required that the facility be built on transportation routes where there were bus routes so that those in transition could go to school, go work at jobs, etc. And while things were underway at Markham, they just weren't moving fast enough. And we looked next door at Dixmoor, and there was Dixmoor with nothing, absolutely nothing. Now, what I'm about to tell you may not have anything to do with anything, but the mayor of Dixmoor...
And this is if you could capsulize this, we'd appreciate it. We still have a pretty lengthy agenda, and the weather's bad.
Well, I've made my point.
Okay.
And if I haven't,
no,
I'll
said,
be responsive
you
to
did.
It. That was the third one.
Okay.
Okay. Now, one last comment, and then I am finished, Mr. Chairman. And
very
that
well.
That is that the proposal from the Department of Corrections, one, it says only 130 beds, it's 200. They repeatedly say in several responses to several questions that the real estate taxes were over $1 million. That's not true. And I've addressed the other things, but the three main points were the things we wanted to leave with you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is John Bradshaw. I am the owner of that facility. As Bruce said, we constructed that in 1999, and it was a 10-year lease. That lease, I have the brochure that I passed around. I had several other state buildings, which my partner was involved in, and he's deceased, and I only have the Jesse Ma Houston. So I say that to say that I'm familiar with the leases with the state of Illinois. The leases of those facilities, when they expired, the real estate taxes then was incorporated into the rent. I was suspecting that that may have would happen here. Now, with respect to that, the terms in the lease, prior to the expiration, the owner would notify the state and alert them that the lease is going to expire, and therefore you would probably have some negotiations. I had called, and then certainly with the news and all the other information, we're going to close Jesse Ma Houston, I feverishly tried to find out and to really get some verification that this facility was going to close. It was only until Thursday when I called someone in the state building, and they says, here, John, look on the website, and boom, there's plastered all across it, the closure of Jesse Ma Houston. The holdover began in August of this year. No negotiation, nothing in terms of the lease or whatever. Now, with respect to Westside, I said that the rent there is $64,000 a month. I could reduce my rent lower than that right now. No negotiation, no talk with anyone. The first official capacity that I've talked to anyone is sitting right here. With respect to the
I think that's for you to deal directly offline from this hearing with Central Management Services. I think the reason why we asked you to come forward is to give us more backstory on the history of the real estate transaction that gets factored into the larger question of the economic viability of the facilities, which factors into the even larger question of whether or not it works within the Department of Corrections budget, which is what brings us here today. Please proceed.
Good evening. Mr. Chairman, I am the mayor of the village of Dixmoor, and I represent the residents that now are 4,000 in numbers. And largely, most of the talk today was based on the value, or better yet, no reports that were available to distinctly talk about the value of the sale from Jesse Ma Houston. However, there is a value that is placed and should be placed on the people of Dixmoor. We certainly have some economic deficit impacts that the closing of Jesse Ma Houston affects not only the retail development that is currently in Dixmoor, but also it affects our opportunities to serve our community because of our sales tax, our property taxes. Those are the things that would have such an irreparable deficit on our operation of a town. And we certainly have appreciated the sales tax, the property taxes, as well as the employment opportunities that exist in Dixmoor. Given that, we are certainly given to appeal that the facility be recommended to stay open, that the opportunities be explored to not have a town such as Dixmoor go in a reverse trend that is in right now as far as coming into an uplifted area. We have a hub of the transportation system that I think it meets and exceeds areas other places in the state do not have in terms of the highway systems, the CNN Railroad, the transportations, and so we're certainly making a plea. Much of the information that was presented today, especially with the information provided by State Rep. Will Davis, certainly speaks to the sentiments not only of myself, but also with the constituents that I represent.
Thank you. Are there any questions or questions or comments for members of this panel? Senator Trotter.
Sure. When you talk about the transportation hub, what is the value of that? Are there transitional inmates at Jesse Ma that are from out of state or what? I mean, are they all south side of Chicago? I'm just trying to get the significance. You said you had this transportation hub. So where are they coming from on the train?
I really don't know, but I know when we were entering into the build of the facility, that it was critical from the state that they have that facility because of the proximity of the inmates living in around Chicago. So I don't know about any out of state. Yeah, I don't know about any out of state.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Representative Davis. Oh, sorry. Representative Davis and Representative Bellick. Representative Bellick.
Oh, thank you very much. I know we talked about with Kankakee that the number of inmates is 78 now, but in 2 weeks it's going down to 61. Is that correct? Oh, sorry. That's not it for you. I'm sorry, this wasn't directed. So when you talked about the property taxes were not correct at $1 million, is that what you said?
That's correct. They
and
are
what
not
are
correct.
They?
I think the CMS representative corrected it around approximately $800,000 now. There was a tax appeal that has reduced them. That was the last amount that was actually paid. The most recent tax appeal has got those reduced down to about $600,000.
Yeah, and the last, October 2nd installment that I just received was reduced more than 50%. That I paid, and the state has that bill, more than 50% reduction in the second half real estate taxes of 08 that I just paid.
That amount was how much?
$241,000.
And as the owner, have you made any capital improvements in the facility over the last 10 years?
No, just the maintenance of the facility. My responsibility is certainly if there's any HVAC, plumbing, et cetera, that is my responsibility to fix. If the inmates or if there's any damages to the washrooms or the showers or whatever, again, it's my responsibility to fix, but then I bill the state for those repairs. But other than that, everything is my expense. Mm-hmm. And so there's not been any major improvements or anything that needs to be done to the facility. And I mean, for an example, and it won't take a long time, I go by there personally myself periodically. Once a month, I was just there about a week ago, 10 days ago, and found some things wrong. I called a repairman. They didn't call me on it. I called and repaired it with a 9-month behind rent and taxes for $900,000.
Thank you.
Representative Davis.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just a little bit more confused. So you dispute the $1 million tax bill. You do.
It's about $900,000. Well, based on this last reduction of over 50% in the last tax bill, second half of the tax bill, last year it was $600,000. Now it's $241,000. So I have to wait till March for the first tax bill in March to really kind of balance that off to see. But it is not $900,000.
Representative,
because of the appeals that we made, ain't got to be fixed. And we're hoping to get it down. We're appealing to get it down to $440,000. That's where it's standing. We won 3 appeals this year.
I was just going to. We have a letter from the firm that we hired to do the tax reduction work, which just says just that, and confirms what the reductions have been and what the currently it's pending the State Property Tax Appeal Board. Is looking at 2008 taxes, and the goal is to reduce the tax liability
for 2009 down to about $449,000.
Okay, well, then obviously corrections or CMS has different information than you, so I guess we'll get to the bottom of that information. But you don't have anything from the assessor's office that speaks to what you're saying?
We do, tax bills.
You do have tax bills.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Another statement you made is that you feel that the cost of inmate figure is inaccurate because it's based on the number of inmates there, but you're saying if the facility had more inmates, then that cost figure would actually be less. Is
yes,
that what I understand?
Yes, sir,
saying?
That's right.
Okay, so you don't feel a need to renegotiate the lease. You feel that what's being paid to you is appropriate then?
No, sir. There are two different things in my mind. Being responsive to the assertions that at a $4.2 million annual operating cost based upon 81 inmates, you have a $50,000 per inmate cost. I was only responding to that to say that if that facility were filled to capacity as it was designed to be used, then that cost per inmate would be in half. With respect to renegotiating and everything, separate issue, and John has said certainly he would do that. Absolutely he would do it.
Okay, but you've never been approached by corrections to do that, is what you're saying. Okay. But again, you felt that what was being paid to you was appropriate then, correct?
Yeah.
Because you say you're willing to negotiate it down because obviously you don't want to lose the business.
Yeah.
But prior to that, you felt that what was being paid to you was correct.
Yeah, when you say, and that's a good question, when you say it was appropriate, you know, you may think there's a profit margin and all that, and it's true. But when we build a facility, I really wanted to, and I'm going to kind of correct myself a little bit, but usually when you build a facility, you incorporate your expenses. And one of the big expenses is your mortgage, your note. And that's paid over a period of et cetera. Well, I really wanted to do this in 10 years to pay it out. And because they wanted the facility and whatever, I couldn't. So I took a 10-year note with a 15-year amortization. I still have 5 years left on it. So when you're billing it, you're billing it according to the construction cost and expense. That's what we're doing. That's what we did. And so that figure that we have now, which is $777,000 a year, that figure was also incorporated in because of the cost of the acquisition of land, et cetera, and the cost to build the building. And that's how we arrive at that figure. And there's not a lot of fat in it, believe me.
I'm just simply asking your opinion.
Yeah, so that's how we arrive at that.
Okay.
And the state, you know, views it and reviews it and everything, and we go back and forth and, you know, negotiate, and that's what we came up with.
Okay, and Representative Belloc asked about any major maintenance, and I forget how she exactly said it, but I think she's wondering if you've done any major infrastructure repairs. I mean, you know, it's. I mean, are we talking about buildings that have cracks in the foundation? You know, any of those things. And you said that you've done maintenance on it, but what about, are there issues with the foundation? Are there... You know,
as Bruce has said there, you know, in the report, it says that there was landfill. No, there was some tile that popped up on the floor. Those things were immediately taken care of. So there's no structural damage or nothing to the building. The building is fine. The washroom, after 10 years of having inmates, you know, you have an A wing, B wing, which is the first floor, C wing, D wing is the second floor. A wing is the one that has all the furniture in it, not being used. Not being used for several years. The washrooms are in bad repair. The shower area is in bad repair. And part of that is because of what they spec'd when we built that facility. And it was about 18 months that we had to make repairs on that. And the state did pay that cost. And as we went forward, it still deteriorated. And then with about three, I think it was 07, probably at my expense, I put tile around the shower areas about 4 feet from the floor up at my expense.
So you didn't bill the state for that?
Didn't bill the state. And there's things that I don't bill the state for. There was a leak there when I was about 10 days ago on the back refrigerator. I had my people repair that.
Excuse me, Representative Davis, I'd like to move the discussion along this evening beyond the actual physical condition of the site. That's one of several variables that the Department of Corrections cited in their decision within the larger policy that they have and in the larger budget which they have to make this specific recommendation. We're spending an inordinate amount of time, with all due respect, on the finer points of the actual physical plant. And we haven't even begun to discuss but touch the surface of how this may or may not affect those people who are currently employed there and the larger economic questions that you wanted to address.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Then I'll reserve the rest for later.
Okay, great. Mayor?
Mr. Chairman, I also want to point out that the Village of Dixmoor currently has an operating budget of $5 million. Mm-hmm. With the elimination of the property taxes that would come from Jesse Ma Houston, which would be close to, if not at one-fifth elimination, that's 20%, that would be cut for servicing our community.
So a 20% reduction in your revenue base.
Revenue base, which would 20%. Affect our servicing. Okay. And many right now, we're right at compliance with state compliance levels. And I just can't see how we would be able to operate with that void.
Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. Any other questions or comments, members of the commission or other elected officials here? Thank you very much for your participation this evening. Are there? We're at the portion of the agenda where we're hearing testimony from elected officials. Are there any other elected officials who are here to offer testimony? If not, we're going to hear from, yes, sir.
Yes, if it'd be all right, I have a letter from Congresswoman Debbie Halverson that we'd like to read. And this was also mailed to your office in Springfield as well. I am writing on behalf of the 11th Congressional District of Illinois to express my opposition to the closure of the Kankakee Minimum Security Unit. The state of Illinois currently has an unemployment rate of 10.5%. In the area near the prison, Kankakee County's unemployment rate is 13.3%, and Will County's is 9.9%. Cutting the 43 jobs at Kankakee Minimum Security Unit will exacerbate the region's unemployment and will put further strain on state unemployment resources and local social service agencies. It should also be noted that KMSU is the only female minimum security unit in the state of Illinois, and a significant portion of the inmates are from the city of Chicago. KMSU's strategic location near Chicago is critical so the inmates can have regular contact with family and friends who aid in the reincorporation process. This closure could have a negative impact on the state's goal to reincorporate women back into society. Thank you for your consideration on this issue. If I can be of further assistance, please do not hesitate to contact me or my staff at 202-225-3635. Sincerely, Debbie Halverson, Member of Congress.
Thank you. And your name for the record? Excuse me, and your name for the record is?
Sorry about that. Nicholas Allen, I'm the regional director for Congresswoman Debbie Halverson.
Thank you. Please give her our regards. Well, we're now on the portion of the agenda where we will hear from representatives of the employee organizations. Representatives from AFSCME Council 31 could come forward, please. In beginning your remarks, if everyone could please identify themselves for the record and your affiliation, we'd appreciate it. Thank you. No. You have to push the button, hold it till it turns green. Or slide it.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. My name's Ken Pataki, Regional Director for AFSCME Council 31 and Union's Chief Liaison for the Department of Corrections. I'm here today to express our union's opposition to the closure of Kankakee MSU and to the reduction of the ATC beds that would occur under the current closure plan for Jesse Ma Houston. To expedite, because I appreciate we agreed to consolidate, I brought three members of our locals with that will also testify, so we'll try to expedite our presentation. I'm going to go and speak specifically to issues we have in each closure. First, I want to point out that it's unfortunate that we didn't have more information at the outset from the department about these closures. Both closures are clearly driven by budget problems, not sound policy rationales. We requested more information about the impact of these closures weeks ago and only received this information last night, suggesting that the department initiated these closures without any clear idea of what the alternatives might be. We painfully are aware that budget problems do exist. However, you are going to have even bigger budget problems if you eliminate these programs like these with proven track records for reducing recidivism. The director of DOCB speaks frequently about early release and about diversion programs he hopes to create, and that he hopes will mean fewer inmates in the system. But right now, we have facilities over capacity, understaffed, without sufficient counseling, education, and other programming. The result is a high rate of recidivism. Simply releasing inmates before their sentences are completed will not reduce the rate unless these structures in place to help these individuals become productive members in their communities. When you eliminate ATC beds, which prepare inmates for their early release and get them ready for community living, that will mean greater reentry problems, not improvements. When you close a facility that houses women in a healing environment where their family is free to visit frequently and most are getting treatment for their addictions, you'll create rather than solve problems. This is specifically true when you move some women to facilities farther away from their families, facilities which house more serious offenders without the same kind of therapeutic environment. Regarding Jesse Ma Houston, this is a facility that prepares inmates for reentry into our communities. Director Randall, in recent address to the John Howard Association, spoke of the importance of ATCs to the department's programs of improving inmate reentry into the communities. The department's COGFA filing is confusing. The numbers it provides on ATC capacity are different than those numbers provided in its quarterly report to the legislature. The last such report DOC filed for July of 2009 showed ATC for male offenders were operating at an average of 93% capacity, not the 81% capacity the department reported in its COGFA filing. The COGFA filing purports to show a drop-off in ATC population, but it is a DOC cause that drop-off. Courts do not place inmates in ATCs. The DOC prison-based counselors recommended inmates for placement, and then DOC Central Office makes the final decision on who is appropriate for placement. The sharp three-month drop in ATC population was clearly as a result of the DOC's decision to reduce replacements, a decision which stands in stark contrast to the director's stated goal of improving prisoner reentry through other means. Turning to Kankakee MSU, closing this facility is a disservice to the women in Illinois who are sentenced to nonviolent crimes and are considered to be low security risk. They will now serve their sentences among more serious and violent offenders. As KMSU is the only minimum security prison for women in the state. As with Jesse Ma Houston, the materials DOC filed with CAGFA regarding this closure are confusing. The DOC claimed the female population in 09 was between 2,700 and 2,800 inmates, where now it is only some 2,500. In fact, DOC's quarterly report for the legislature shows the female population has been steady at about 2,600 inmates for the past 3 years. And in October, according to data provided in the filing, was slightly higher than it was, in fact, in July. One final piece of information that we asked for should be noted for its absence. We asked the department to tell us how many inmates will be sent to each of the three facilities they state will be used in KMSU inmates, Decatur and Lincoln, which are minimum security, and Dwight, which is a maximum security facility. They still have not answered this question. What DOC did say is that the inmates will also be given the opportunity to go to Fox Valley. However, this facility has consistently been operating at 20% over capacity for the last 3 years. And by the department's own figures for July, August, September, and October, it is 120% capacity. Today, I have with me some employees from these facilities. And then again, to expedite the process, I'm going to let each one take a moment and speak for their facility, and then we'll be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Chairman, my name is LaVon Borders. I am a correctional residence counselor at Jesse Ma Houston Adult Transitional Center. We need Adult Transitional Center to reduce our recidivism rate in Illinois. And we need the Adult Transitional Center in the south side of Chicago or the south suburbs. When an inmate comes out of prison, they're confused about their environment when they come out of incarceration. For instance, they don't know how to get their credentials, look for housing or find employment, or how to reconnect with their families. The Adult Transitional Center program shows them how to do these things before they go out on parole. We build a foundation for them so they have the support they need when they leave the transitional center, transitional environment, excuse me. For these men, hustling and street life is the way of life for them when they return to our communities. They don't know how to live a lifestyle free of the criminal element. In most cases, they return back to the street or go back to their former lifestyles. At some point, they return back to prison. When an inmate comes to an adult transitional center, first, before paroling out from prison, they have a better chance of reconnecting to jobs, finding housing, going back to school, or getting their GED or applying for further education such as college. We help them budget their earnings, including paying a percentage of their income as rent to the state. We also provide other services, including parenting classes, anger management, stress management, relationship building, and substance abuse counseling. These services provide a structured environment to assist in their preparation to transition back into our communities. Our facility was named in honor of Jesse Ma Houston, who fought for inmates' rights. Her stepson was killed in prison. She devoted her life, visiting inmates and uplifting them and encouraging them to straighten out their lives. This is a beautiful legacy, and this facility has lived up to that legacy by helping inmates and their families and our community. We want this facility to remain open, but we understand there are some problems with the building, etc. We do not want to lose that name of Jesse Ma Houston. If that is the case, we would like Jesse Ma Houston to be opened up at another site, maybe on the south side of Chicago or the south suburbs. Let her legacy live on. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Cheryl O'Brien, and I have been a state employee for 18 years and an educator at KMSU for 9 years. I want to talk about why DOC needs a minimum security facility for women. KMSU was established as the result of a lawsuit known as Moorhead versus McGinnis. Inmate advocates sued the state to force DOC to open a minimum security facility to give women the greater freedom and access to programs that male DOC inmates in minimum security facilities have. There was a consent decree signed in 1991 that states defendants, that's DOC, shall by no later than September 30th, 1993, designate at least one facility with at least 200 beds for female inmates, which is classified as minimum security. Illinois needed a minimum security facility then, and we still need one now. None of the other female correctional facilities are minimum security. Dwight is maximum security, Decatur and Lincoln are medium, and Fox Valley is an adult transition center. The men currently have 13 minimum level facilities. Closing KMSU would leave the women with zero. DOC is saying our inmates will go to Dwight, Lincoln, and Decatur, which means they will all go to higher level security facilities. Kankakee MSU looks completely different from even a medium security prison. It is an atmosphere conducive to family visits and self-improvement, which is what women sentenced to relatively minor crimes and showing good behavior are entitled to. There are no fences. Women sleep two to a room instead of in large dorms or cells. We have an open visiting policy, and because we are small, we know our women and are able to help move them forward, and that is what changes lives. I had a student who earned her GED this year. She had a hard time with math, missing a passing score by 10 points. But I, as well as fellow offenders, gave her individual support and encouragement that helped her succeed. She told me if she would have been serving time anywhere else, she would have just quit. She is going home a changed person. When she's asked on a job application if she has her high school diploma, she can say yes. She can go to college or a vocational school now. She'll have more opportunities because she was in a place where she wasn't a number. The women at Kankakee are low-level offenders. They made bad choices. We all make bad choices, though some worse than others. Our mission at DOC is supposed to be punishment and reform. But DOC is talking about sending these women to Dwight, which is maximum security. These low-level offenders will be swallowed up at Dwight. I understand there are now women sitting in intake for 2 months or more, waiting for a medium security bed. Some of these women could work with our program. But DOC seems to be classifying more and more inmates as medium security. We had an inmate previously at Kankakee MSU who came back into the system. She was classified as medium security this time around, supposedly because she has a previous arrest for arson. This doesn't make any sense. It was an arrest, not a conviction. It was a one-time offense, not a pattern. It occurred when she was a juvenile. And it was on her record the last time she served time at KMSU. It didn't matter last time if she was classified minimum. Now it's convenient to call her more of a threat. That means she is with more hardcore offenders instead of in a place that can make a difference. I hear at least weekly from the women they would prefer to do their sentence at KMSU. Despite the budget cuts that we have endured over the past few years, that have greatly reduced the programs offered at KMSU. The women at KMSU are still able to work on skills to turn their lives around due to the environment and access to support, not only from staff, but from family. KMSU is an asset to a system that wants to make a difference. If DOC wants to get rid of KMSU, what does that say about our state's commitment to offering these women, their families, and their communities another chance? Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Sandra Boykman. I've worked for the Department of Corrections for almost 15 years. The last 8.5 years as a correctional counselor at Kankakee Minimum Security Unit. At KMSU, we are a community that works towards a greater good. KMSU is designed to reintegrate women into the community. I know the department has said they will have jobs available for staff at KMSU, but they aren't saying there will be another minimum security facility for our female offenders, because there won't be. The women will be going to maximum or medium level facilities. The women at KMSU and all future offenders classified as minimum security are going to be hurt by this closure. I've worked at other DOC facilities, and I've talked to offenders who have done time at other prisons where DOC plans to send these women. Those places don't have the same environment at all. Some of our DOC facilities are rough places because of the number and type of inmates they house. KMSU is a much more open place, and with that open environment comes a different attitude from the residents and the staff. Our women don't have the same hostility towards each other or the same guardedness towards staff. Being a small facility, the women get a lot more one-on-one attention from staff. I know the women on my caseload, and I see them pretty much every day. At a large facility, you might see your counselor once a month or less. At KMSU, the women are not just a number, and that makes it more likely we can turn them around. Some of our service providers who work with our women have commented to me that our women are easier to help because they don't have a wall up around them like inmates at other prisons. What's it like at a larger, more secure facility? One of the women on my caseload who transferred from Lincoln Correctional Center, a medium security prison, told me they issue inmates their own roll of toilet paper every few days. The inmates have to put their name on their roll of toilet paper and guard it, or another inmate might take it and you won't get another one to replace it. That seems like a small thing, but it's part of a mindset where everybody has to look out for themselves or somebody might take advantage. We are not like that at KMSU. Everybody has access to necessities. You get what you need. The women don't have to fight each other for it. We can do that because we have only minimum security women who are not dangerous, and they are housed with women like them. When you have minimum security women who are in for crimes like writing bad checks and retail theft, and you put them in with more dangerous inmates who have done more serious crimes like murder and armed robbery, you have to be more secure. It also means that the women in for less serious crimes might spend their time learning to be a better criminal instead of turning their lives around. I've heard back from women we've helped. One woman called to tell me that KMSU saved her life. She said now she's a different person than the addict she was. She's going to school, she has her kids back, and she's doing fantastic. I remember another woman on my caseload who was fighting to retain custody of her children. Their father in another state wanted to take them while she was incarcerated, although her current husband was bringing the kids to KMSU for regular visits. We arranged for the social worker on the case to come and observe a visit at our center. The social worker agreed that the atmosphere was completely non-threatening for the kids. The offender was able to retain custody of her children. Based on our current population, 86% of our women come from the northern part of the state. I calculate the numbers every month, and I can tell you that over 80% of the KMSU women are mothers. Family visits are very important to both for the women and their families, especially if they have children. If you have a young child, you can't keep a bond over the phone. We are the closest female facility to Cook County. Proximity makes a big difference for families without reliable transportation. It is also more intimidating for children and unpleasant for families to walk into a higher security facility. A woman on my caseload was previously incarcerated at Decatur. She saw her daughter only once. Now she visits twice a month. That has made a world of difference in her relationship with her daughter. At KMSU, we've suffered from program cuts like a lot of other prisons. We still have our adult basic education and GED classes. The Wells Center offers substance abuse counseling to our women. We also provide parenting classes. I understand KMSU was first created when inmate advocates sued the state to get women prisoners the right to do their time in a low security setting with more programs. Kankakee MSU was worth fighting for then. It's worth fighting for now. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments from members of the commission for this panel? Anyone on this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your participation. Thank you. We'll enter this into the record. We have letters from residents of KMSU. Are there any other members of, employee organizations who are slated to testify? If not, we'll move to the next panel.
Okay. I have a
Thank you. We go to Mount Houston, and they called me in 1980, January 5th, my mom died, and Mr. Shalia was the deputy director of human service, called me. Mr. Dale Franzen was the director and asked me if they could name the release of community center after my mom and use her for hospital. In memory of Jesse Mon Houston, who devoted her entire life to improving the plight of incarcerated and whose mission in their behalf paved the way for change and progress. Illinois Department of Corrections. Now, they asked me if they could do that. The state representative of that was Harold Washington, the late Harold Washington, and Dick Newhouse, Senator Margaret Smith, all of those people voted that Von Houston's name should be on a correctional center. So we named it that. It was 720 North Dearborn. I came down and took women who had never been out. They had been in prison since they were very young. I would go there and take them to the zoo, take them to John Hancock, take them to places they'd never been, take them to Walgreens. This is the first time I've ever been out when I wasn't casing the joint. And so, I mean, this is what we did with them. And some of those women have come back to my Houston to say, now I have a work release center in my community because I opened one. So this is very important. I've been to Westside, but it didn't feel the same as my Houston because her philosophy wasn't there. I have nothing against it. But the philosophy of Mount Houston and these sisters who have been working there for years, I know them. And we are part of, see, when they opened it, it was because the community was supposed to be involved. If the community isn't involved, it's not a correctional, community correction. And ATC is what Mr. Snyder changed the name to. I don't know what that meant. But I know that the community was a part of it. And we would, we'd have a board of directors, of advisors who worked with them. I remember we put on fashion shows, we introduced the community. I had people that I took to church who joined church. They became members. That's what it's all about. Now, I don't know why. Well, I know it's money. But I don't quite understand why it isn't filled. Why the people aren't in there? Because brothers used to write in and say, I want to go to my Houston. They would work towards that. They try to do better in prison so they could go to my Houston. But I don't understand why there's not 200 people in there. I don't get that. If he has $43,000, I know I don't know. If you got 43,000 people, you don't have 200 could go to my Houston? I don't quite understand. It's surprising to me. My mama had me in the prison going since with five young men, was on death row at Cook County Jail. That was many years, 1945. And so I've been going to prison since. In 1971, we transferred to Stateville, Pontiac, Joliet, Menard. And I have a team of people from the Jesse Mount Houston Prison Ministry of the Rainbow Push Coalition with Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, who still go to all these prisons. And we got people that go to Mount Houston. They had people to go to Chicago State and graduate because of the teachers we had at Mount Houston. So we think it's very important for it to be there. I don't know whether we have to take up a collection or have a, I don't know. But we just need that place there. I know that. And I don't understand when they say it's falling down. It is new. I mean, I remember when he built it, people said how beautiful this place is, all this blue. And I said, it sure is pretty.
I know.
Yeah, I know. And the females, I see them now, people who've been there. But the point is, I also see young men now who are out of prison, and most of them who came up under the programs that we've been involved in, they're the ones who look like doctors and lawyers, who are working with the lawyers in the law schools, like Duffy Clark and all those people. I see them, and they come to Operation Breadbasket, they volunteer. The people at Von Houston used to come down and help pack the turkeys and for the people who needed them. They come down and become a part of the community. That's what it's about. Mr. Molina, can you help us? See, I trained him. I do a good job. That's one of my baby children. But anyway, somehow or other, we got to find a way to keep Mount Houston open because, I mean, one of my friends has put it on the network, and it's just going all over the world that they're trying to close Mount Houston. And I'm like somebody else who said, nobody told me. I said, if the Department of Correction, State of Illinois, called me and asked me could they name it, it looked like somebody would have called and tell me, can we close it? Nobody asked my permission.
Don't let me get all my children from down south who work in an NA and AA. They bring their team of people that they have saved and have them to do some one-on-one, you know, show you all what we can do. So thank you, Mr. Director. We're going to meet very soon, right? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Donnie Trotter. It's one of my sons.
Thank you.
See, I got all these children in and out of the prison.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify at this time? Good evening.
Good evening. I'm Sister Patricia Slosser, and I'm a social worker. And I think the panel already knows me because you've received my letter and my petitions and all of the remarks that I have made. I'm here as a social worker and someone who's vitally interested in re-entry. Because I've been a social worker 50 years, 40 in Chicago, and I have been going to Kankakee for 10 every week, sometimes twice a week. And I've done resource classes and reentry classes, scripture reflection classes. And that is what I want to speak to, because Kankakee is the perfect reentry site. And if we don't spend money on reentry, we will double our cost when women return. Women really have responsibilities that are different than men. So the kind of reentry that they need to be prepared for is to reintegrate with their families as the sole supporters, which is not true of most of the men in prison. They have to reintegrate into society with very few skills sometimes, and so they need to have that tended to. And yet, we were able to open two men's treatment centers recently because it was considered so important. So I know that it is considered important by the Department of Corrections. So we really need to take a look at why then Kankakee could be such an important reentry site. When I first started going there, there were always 200 women. We know that 80% of women in prison are minimum security. They are in for nonviolent crime. So certainly there are 200 that could be funneled back into Kankakee. If they are going to be funneled into other institutions, even though the programs are there, those programs have waiting lists. So the women are not necessarily going to avail themselves of those programs. Kankakee is the only institution in the state where there's no waiting list for treatment. In fact, you're going to hear from one of the women that runs the treatment program. The other thing that has been really important to me as I go to Kankakee is that it is an extremely professional institution. And what I mean by that is they have a counselor with a master's in social work, rare in the Department of Corrections. That's not even a requirement. They have an excellent treatment program. In fact, we're bringing a former inmate to talk to that particular issue. They have an excellent education program, but besides that, their officers are professional. That too is an exceptional plus for Kankakee. And so I would invite you as a panel to just go south about 10 miles and drive by that site. It's beautiful, it's small, it's open. It's exactly what people who are reentering society need, because they are going to be re-entering not a closed society, not a fenced-in society, but an open society. And so I ask you to consider re-entry at the top of your list.
Good evening. I'm Betty Jones, and I am the Program Director for the Wells Center Substance Abuse Treatment Program, which serves the inmates at Kankakee Minimum Security Unit. Among the 14 Level 7 minimum security facilities operated by DOC, CAMSU is the only one that serves the women. I have been with CAMSU program since 1994. In fact, I and four other staff members in the substance abuse program have a combined total of 34 years. You don't see staff retention like that in many contracted corrections programs. We work for a state contractor, but have stayed on at Kankakee even though employer changed. That is a testament to the commitment of all our staff, but also to the unique environment at KMSU that let us enjoy working in a truly successful program. The small population at KMSU create many opportunities for recovery. We have 60 slots in our treatment program, and we have virtually no waiting list. That means most of all the women at KMSU are in treatment and are committed to recovery. So the environment is very supportive and reinforcing. If our women go to another facility, they would be placed on a waiting list for treatment, which would delay their personal growth and recovery. That small size also allows for more individualized treatment. For example, our groups include 20 women, whereas some of the larger facilities, you would see 40 people in a group or more. That makes it much harder to connect with these women. Most of the women who come to KMSU have substance abuse in their background, and it's often related to their conviction. Women who are in for possession, prostitution, theft, these are the women who benefit most from intensive treatment, which we provide at KMSU. Our program is gender specific, which allows us to explore some of the issues that might drive their poor choices. And because we are a facility for lower level offenders, the women are open with each other. They are grateful to be more in a more friendly environment, and there is no fear factor. Closing KMSU would be a setback for the women who have been working with. While at KMSU, they have been in a supportive environment, separated from hardened criminals. They will now be moving to prisons with women who have committed more serious crimes with fewer opportunities for treatment. These women are very much a product of their environments. I fear for them once they leave our safe, supportive environment and move to these larger and harsher settings. They may no longer be committed to recovery and may instead simply learn to be better criminals. The closure is being talked about purely as a way to save money. The department is not saying it will use those savings to increase our programs or treatment for these women. The Wells Center has already been notified that its contract will be canceled. DOC is not proposing to add substance abuse treatment programs at the prisons that will receive our inmates. But closing KMSU could end up costing more money. The Wells Center tracks recidivism for its program graduates and compares it to DOC general population inmates. Our program for women cuts recidivism in half, 22% of our women compared to 44% in the DOC general population. Keeping women out of prison saves the state money, not just in reduced incarceration costs, but also in reduced child welfare costs. I'm gonna say that again. Keeping women out of prison saves the state money, not just in reduced incarceration costs, but also in reduced child welfare costs. The department says it's committed to reducing recidivism, then it should be lifting up the KMSU program, not closing it. And now I have one of our former clients of the Wells Center who successfully completed our Wells treatment program. She's here today to provide her testimony. Please welcome Lavetta Winston, and thank you.
Hi, my name is Lavetta Winston. First, I count it a privilege as well as an honor to be here. Being a former inmate in a variety of prisons, I'm here today not just to stand out just for Kankakee, but for the staff as well. And to be in this place and to have them all here surrounding me and I'm not getting handcuffed, it feels good. No. But that they, to be here, and they play a big part in my life today. And I'm here not just for the prison, I'm here for the women and their children. I know numbers are involved financially, but there's a bunch of numbers involved as far as the next generation is concerned. There are women that I engaged with in KMSU that were just getting to have close contact with their children. I myself don't have children, but I was incarcerated there for 2.5 years in the Wells program, which I graduated from. And while I was there, I never had a chance to interact with my family. I hurt a lot of people in the midst of my drug addiction. Kankakee provided for me just about everything I needed as far as a foundation to come out here and be productive in society, which I'm doing today. Not only am I drug free, I'm working on my high school diploma, which I started working in KMSU, but I chose to graduate from the skills of lifestyle first. I need to learn how to live. Getting a GED was important to me, but I need to learn how to live first. I'm also going to Michael Barlow School in Chicago. I transitioned from Kankakee to Grace House program, which I presently live at this moment. I'm really here more for the ladies. There are so many women there that I know that are waiting to come to where I'm at. And if it's be interrupted, then they won't be able to go to this transitional center where they can become productive. I also wanted to share about how, yeah, I've been to other prisons, but they didn't have what Kankakee gave me. There was so many programs for me. I did my AANA, I went to school. I had a lot of spiritual programs and the Wells programs. The counselors, the staff that work there, to me, I don't see them as just being there for their money. They're here to help people. I mean, some of the issues I had, I could talk to them and they share with us. It's a small environment. So for me today, I just wanted to say that I pray that there'll be a change of heart, not only for just the women, but their children and the families that need to come together. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
Can I ask a brief question, Mr. Davis? Chairman? I've heard several times you indicate that the women that may be transferred to other facilities will ultimately become better criminals. I think that was those your exact words. So you're saying that they're going to be, the populations are going to be mixed?
Yes, the populations will be mixed because you're not.
Excuse me, could you use the microphone? Thanks.
From my understanding, Kankakee Minimum Security Unit came about because the women wanted a minimum security unit. Men had it already, and they had other opportunities that the women did not have. And from my understanding, that is why they came up with the Kankakee Minimum Security Union. Now you want to take the only, and I have to stress that, the only minimum security, number one, just one, in the state of Illinois, you want to take that away and put these ladies back with women who are there for murders at Dwight and other facilities to cater. These are minimum, medium, and maximum security. Okay, they say they might put them over there and have a mix them. They're going to mix them. They're still going to be with maximum and medium security inmates. It's not a separate facility. Kankakee Minimum Security Unit is a separate facility from the rest.
I mean, I understand it's a separate facility, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I understand mm-hmm. what you're saying, but I guess maybe corrections should at some point offer some information. I'm curious, a woman who would be normally be housed at this center, if they get transitioned back into one of the other facilities, are they going to be in with women who are committed worse crimes? I guess that's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
I'm just curious.
Yes,
I'm just curious.
The women at our facilities are like with theft, prostitution, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. They're minimum. They're going to go to a higher level of security at Dwight or Decatur, which is maximum and medium. These are hardened criminals. These are people who committed really, really big crimes, you know.
I understand. And yes, then also what you're saying is that if women are put into other facilities, the services that they receive at Kankakee will not go with them to other facilities?
They may have, at Dwight, they do have a substance abuse program. However, there's usually a waiting list. We have virtually no waiting lists at Kankakee. Usually when those women come in, they're immediately into treatment or education programming. That is not the case at Dwight. There's waiting lists.
Okay, so in that case, it would be a call for if this facility does close and if women have to be transferred, that services should follow them no matter what. Correct.
Basically, they may be offered substance abuse or GED at Dwight or at Decatur. However, that don't mean once they leave Kankakee that they will. They're going to be in a bigger environment. And once they get there, their choice or their desire to change may, because they're going to be more influenced by hardened criminals, may not be there.
Okay, thank you.
Could I just add one thing also?
Certainly.
The visiting is not the same in the larger institutions of the family. So at Kankakee, they have open visiting, but they do not in the larger. So that also is going to be less. And I consider that really, really important.
So does that mean that you are offering recommendations, though? I mean, I understand that you would prefer that it stay open, but in the sense that it may, instead of just taking a we're against it position, are you also offering recommendations to corrections to say that if women have to be housed in these other facilities, that these are some of the things that need to happen to make sure that they don't, as you indicate, become better criminals or whatever the case may be? I'm sensitive to what you're saying about keeping the facility, the only facility, as you stressed. But if it does happen, I hope that you are also having dialogue with corrections about things that they need to improve on to make sure that, you know, women who are transferring possibly to other facilities still have the chance for a better life.
Absolutely.
After they complete
absolutely.
Their sentence.
Absolutely. At every program, Indicator as well as into White, there are other programs. There is a substance abuse program. And there, I'm sure there's parenting and other things been offering there, too. However, for most of those programs at Kankakee, we don't have a waiting list, virtually no waiting list. When they go there, they're going to be in competition for a few slots. We can guarantee you pretty much at Kankakee, 100% of our clients, if you want the program, you can get it, whether it's GED, ABE, Well Center, Substance Abuse Program, parenting, or whatever it may be. They virtually no waiting list for any programs. That's the difference.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Bellick.
I just wanted to say thank you very much for your very moving testimony. We enjoyed it. And I would like to ask the director how, I guess I just, my question is, like the lady said, I can't understand how there'd be only 80 women out of 2,000 and some that would qualify for that type of service. Well, you don't have to come up right now, but I'll ask.
No, actually, you know what? I was going to
ask the same
ask
thing.
A similar question. Director, would you
I mean,
mind coming forward to answer
that question?
I mean, that's
what we're aiming for is... Right.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the issue is when you talk about why only 80 women qualify for the services that, they qualify for minimum security. There are minimum security females at all of our female prisons right now. They are housed in specific housing units in those facilities. They may go to, when they go to lunch, they, you know, we have general population feeding. They're escorted over to their meals. They may very well be in a program or be in the chow hall with other security levels. But I guess, you know, that's why we have staff at those facilities. That's why we have counselors. That's why we have treatment personnel at those other facilities. We have a lot of programming as it relates to female offenders. In fact, if you look at the amount of programming available to women offenders as opposed to men, based on the total numbers as a percentage, a lot of the program opportunities are available to females. I'm not quite sure about waiting lists. It may be for some specific programs that you have waiting lists, and that probably is the case at larger facilities. But the difference is when I'm talking about 2,000 people versus 80 people, and that's why you have some of those circumstances.
But how many minimum security places are there for men?
We have, what do we have, 5 minimum security facilities? Well, if you include the camps. Well, we also have Fox Valley for females. I thought you were just talking about facilities.
No, I was. I was just comparing them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify at this time? If not, that will wrap up the testimony at this hearing this evening. We have until early January to make a vote on this. My suggestion is, if there are any commission members who have any additional questions for the Department of Corrections, if you can get them to the commission staff within the next handful of days, that would be very helpful. We can forward them to the Department of Corrections staff. Otherwise, it appears likely, for the purposes of housekeeping, that we'll either schedule another teleconference hearing the way we have in the past for a vote, or probably more likely when we convene on the 22nd in Sterling, we'll be voting then. With that, I want to thank everybody for your participation and
I
your assistance. Yeah, Representative Bellick.
This is old business, not to do with this. I think, yes. Thank you for bringing it up before, but I had written a letter regarding the closure of Tinley Park.
Yes.
And I asked that we have a rehearing on that, because when we voted on that, we were assured that there would be some other type of facility. I have no update on Tinley Park right now, but from what I've heard through other people, it was as if there was not going to be any replacement for Tinley Park.
If we could, what we'll do is... And I can't speak for Co-Chairman Myers, but what we can do is make a formal request under our signatures.
Thank you.
To the administration.
Thank you.
To let them know that they haven't done that.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate
that.
We're waiting on it. The only other thing I want to say before we adjourn the hearing, I want to wish everybody a very happy holiday season and be careful going home. Thank you very much.